It's November 20th, 2019, and thanks for joining us for another Teaching American History webinar archive. Today's Documents in Detail webinar is about the Webster-Hayne debates of 1830, considered by many to be an outstanding exposition on some of the core causes of the Civil War. Thanks for joining us.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Moser, professor of history and chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. Welcome to another action-packed episode of Documents in Detail, Teaching American History's webinar series, in which we bring together thoughtful scholars to have a conversation about historically important documents. We encourage all of you joining us today to participate in that conversation by submitting questions via the chat box, and we will try to get to as many of those questions as possible. Within the next week, you will be receiving an email with a link, and you may go to that link to request a certificate of participation if you wish. There will also be a link in that email to the archived video and audio from tonight's program. The speeches, letters, and other writings that we're using for this year's webinars are all drawn from our book, 50 Core American Documents. If you are not familiar with that volume, you should be. Go to tah.org to find out more information about that. And of course, you can find all sorts of resources at our voluminous document database located at tah.org. The subject of today's program is the Webster-Hayne debates. To help discuss it, I see Eric has joined us, Dr. Eric Sands, Associate Professor of Government at Berry College, and Dr. Jason Stevens, who is a visiting Assistant Professor of Political Science at Ashland University. Thank you to both of you for being here. Eric, can you hear me? Iron out his troubles in a moment. Jason, how are you this evening?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
Fantastic. This is a great document. I'm looking forward to jumping into it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm sorry?
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, just to get us started, why don't you tell us a bit about why this document deserves to be included as one of the 50 core documents for the study of U.S. history?
Yeah, that's a great question, because I'll say this. I had not encountered this document until relatively late in my study of American history and government. I was sort of surprised when I came upon it that I hadn't spent more time with it, because the more I read it, the more I realize its importance in American history and government. This document is important because it really helps to show the deepening divide between the northern and the southern perspectives over the origin and the nature of the American Union, that divide that begins as early as the 1830s, and that we know will eventually erupt in civil war 30 years later. And you see both Webster and Hayne on the floor of the U.S. Senate, you know, raising the specter of civil war here in 1830. What will come down the line actually has its roots, its origins in the Webster-Hayne debates, and specifically in the issues that are raised in those debates regarding the origin and nature of the Union.
Okay. Eric, are you with us?
Yes, I am. I apologize. WebEx was giving me some difficulties.
It'll do that sometimes. I don't know how much of Jason's answer that you heard. I don't know if you care to amplify or add to any of that.
Well, I would just add on. We don't realize it now, but this was the most famous debate in American history through really the mid part of the 20th century, before the Lincoln-Douglas debates really caught on and eclipsed Webster-Hayne as one of the most important debates that took place. But school children throughout the early part of the 20th century would be required to read parts of Webster's second reply to Hayne and memorize them as part of their civics lessons. So this was an immensely important debate that took place. And as Jason said, it does show the deepening divide between North and South. I think it shows a couple other things as well. The idea of sectional identity that is really starting to form and take shape. There's a distinct identity in the West, in the North, in the South. And part of what's going on in the debate between Webster and Hayne is there's an attempt to win over the support of the West, to try to gain an influence in politics and to take a certain ascendancy in domestic legislation. And in addition to that, this is all taking place during a party realignment. We have a new political party, the Democrats, coming into existence. It's going to be only about 6 years before we get the Whigs coming into existence. So everything is really in a state of flux in 1830, socially, culturally, politically. There's a lot of balls up in the air, and I think this debate just comes along at this perfect moment where all of these different issues that are being debated and contested all coalesce into one great conflict.
Is it fair to say that this is the first major clash between North and South? I think Jason at one point said that this is something that develops in the 1830s, and of course, this debate is 1830. For example, there were obviously arguments over Missouri 10 years earlier. How does this differ from that?
Yeah, I could say. I mean, the debate between North and South on many of the issues raised here in the Webster-Hayne debates, right? We're not, new. I mean, there was a tariff and a nullification debate going back to 1828. I think was the first instance of a crisis of that kind. And look, the North and South divide goes back to the American founding as well in many ways. Right at the Constitutional Convention and even at the Second Continental Congress. Right, I'm reminded of Jefferson's rough draft of the Declaration and the part of the Declaration that Jefferson had to take out at the request of his Southern brethren that condemned the slave trade. Not to mention the various compromises that that take place at the Constitutional Convention during the summer of 1787. You've seen the famous Christie painting of the Constitutional Convention with George Washington standing there as the president and Ben Franklin and Alexander Hamilton sitting out front whispering to each other. And then off to the far left, we sometimes neglect I think there are four delegates there all standing up and waving and pointing wildly. This is the South Carolinians. These are the South Carolinians. Who had the best record of attendance of any state at the Constitutional Convention to make sure that any constitution that might emerge from the convention would not destroy slavery.
Eric, any more to add to that?
Just that if there is a new component, it's the introduction of this new argument coming out of South Carolina for states' rights and state nullification. This is a new dimension to the debates between North and South.
Nullification, the so-called Carolina Doctrine, right?
Yeah, the so-called Carolina Doctrine. And they're, of course, referring to the exposition and protest. Carolina has not actually nullified legislation as of 1830. They are considering nullifying legislation. But they have put out this exposition and protest written by John Calhoun. That is still a well-guarded secret in 1830. But he has outlined a doctrine in which he pronounces that the states are sovereign, that ultimately they have the final say and the final authority in the constitutional system, that if legislation is passed that is deemed unconstitutional, the states have the right to nullify it. And in its most radical form, it even goes so far as to say that individual states can nullify legislation that they believe is unconstitutional. And this, of course, has a view towards protecting the institution of slavery itself. The idea that, you know, the North, with its growing population and growing influence in Congress, might try some anti-slavery legislation at some point, and the South would be able to nullify it and would be able to block it. So those dimensions, I think, are somewhat new and are being teased out in this debate. Webster, I think, goads Hayne into talking about the Carolina Doctrine. He just barely mentions it during the first interaction between the two of them, but it's enough to get Hayne's attention, and Hayne kind of takes the bait and comes back and gives a full-throated defense of the Carolina Doctrine, and then that allows Webster to offer his rebuttal about his own theory about the nature of the Union. But I think those parts are somewhat new to the debate.
And actually, if I can add to that a bit, I think the other new thing that you see in these debates, and Eric, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, is the moral defense of slavery that you get from Senator Hayne. Right, that was not present at the Constitutional Convention or the Second Continental Congress. That is something that is I think relatively new here, if not completely new. I mean, this is going back to Calhoun's positive good theory, right? Which I think he won't that his Calhoun speech where he says that is the speech on the reception of abolition petitions from 1837, so about 7 years later after these debates. But you see a moral defense of slavery here from Hayne, which is something that's right you did not get out of the South much prior to this.
It seems to me that Hayne is not quite ready to give a full-throated defense of slavery. So he kind of couches it. This is the bottom of page 9, the way mine printed out. If slavery as it is now, and I'm sorry, the word is blotted out on mine, in this country, be an evil, we of the present day found it ready-made to our hands. Finding our lot cast among a people whom God had manifestly committed to our care, we did not sit down to speculate on abstract questions of theoretical liberty. We met it as a practical question of obligation and duty. He says earlier, we will not stop to inquire whether the black man, as some philosophers have contended, is of an inferior race. Right? It seems to me that within a few years, Southerners were perfectly happy to make that claim. But even Hayne doesn't want to go there quite yet.
Yeah, that's a good point. He says, what was that last line, John? But that was interesting. We will not stop to say that the black man is inferior to the white. But of course, in doing so, he sort of does exactly that, doesn't he? He does stop to make that argument.
And many people are saying that they're inferior.
And in that same section that you were reading from, I think that's where he says, because I was looking at this part, quote, we found that we had to deal with a people whose physical, moral, and intellectual habits and character totally disqualified them from the enjoyment of the blessings of freedom, end quote. Again, maybe not jumping into the positive good pull just yet, but certainly, right, starting to dip their toes in.
Yeah, it's not the full-on mudsill theory, right?
Mm-hmm. But
we're heading in that direction. Let's take a step back from the document itself and talk a little bit about the context. Well, how did this whole debate come to be to begin with? Or that's whichever of you would prefer to answer.
Yeah, I mean, I can tackle that. It was basically an accident. It was, you could almost call it a cosmic accident, given the import of the debate that follows from it. Congress was debating a land bill about what to do with unclaimed Western lands. Senator Foote of Connecticut made a proposal that the surveyor's office be closed, that a lot of unsold land be held and not sold, and that some land postings and stuff be shut down. And it was understood at the time to be a pretty uncontroversial thing until Senator Benton of Ohio gets started and starts railing about how this is a conspiracy by the East to deprive the West of settlers. And that what the East was doing was basically trying to shut off land in the West in order to keep a high population in the eastern cities to work in the factories for low wages. And so he declares that there's a conspiracy afoot against the West. And he even goes so far as to prevail on the South to intervene and to help out the West, as he says they have done in the past. And it's in that context that the debate gets started. When you start the first part of the or Haynes' first remarks, they're all about land. They're all about Western lands, and you almost find yourself going, "What am I reading? I thought this was supposed to be one of the most important debates in American history. And all I'm reading about is, you know, the settlement of Western lands." Well, that's how the debate got started, was over the issue of Western lands. And so that's where it starts. Daniel Webster had actually been busy with other business, I believe, with the Supreme Court. He argued hundreds of cases before the Supreme Court. And walked into the Senate late the day that Hain was giving his speech. And he walked in and caught Hain about halfway through the speech and sat down and started to listen. And then he said that he felt moved to make a reply. History has written that his reply was extemporaneous. It really wasn't. The Senate actually adjourned before Webster offered his first reply, and so he did have a night to think on it before he came back. But he walked in with apparently three pieces of paper with some notes jotted on it about land policy and a couple other things, and then he took off and started running with it at that point and started making some direct attacks on what Hain had said about slavery, about the South, about the East, and a number of other things.
Jason?
Yeah, my understanding is that, right, so the debate gets started over sources of federal revenue, including, right, the sale of Western lands, as Eric mentioned. And they bring up other issues as well. Tariffs, right, can make an appearance at one point, internal improvements. Many of the old, right, points of contention between the parties, although at this time, as Eric mentioned earlier, right, their identities are in flux, you know, come and go. But the real focus of the debates is something much deeper. Right, what starts off as sort of this debate over, right, an issue that would, you know, not seem to lead us into deep waters regarding the American identity and the American mind, right, quickly turns to who are we as one people and what is the origin and nature of our union? Is it a union of individuals? Is it a union of a whole people who have come together to act for their own good? Or is it a union of independent and sovereign states, right, who have joined together in a compact of sorts for the mutual benefit of the states? And through, right, the origins of this debate over Western lands, America... The two debaters, right, quickly reveal that there's sort of an identity crisis at the bottom of these sort of innocuous issues, where Hain and Webster realize we have fundamental disagreements over what this country is about, where this country has come from, and therefore where it's going. So, you know, Hain is there arguing that the sovereign and independent states had created the union to promote their particular interest. And Webster comes back and says, no, the union was not the creation of the states, but the creation of the whole American people to promote the good of the whole. And those two views, I think, are irreconcilable. right? Those are fundamentally different views of the origin and nature of America. And the rest of the debates are, right, trying to square that circle, which cannot be done. And I think Hayne and Webster realize that, and that leads to the coming out of the pages as the debate goes on.
I think it's pretty clear that the central issue here is how each man defines the union. And I don't want to get too far into the weeds here, but I'm struck by this discussion about government revenue. And mm-hmm. the reason for being interested in this, I'll explain it in a moment. But we hear Hayne really make an argument for why direct taxation is superior to having the federal government raise money through the sale of land or indirect taxation. He says in the middle of what for me is page 2, "Can any man believe, sir, that if 23 millions per annum was now levied by direct taxation or by an apportionment of the same among the states, instead of being raised by an indirect tax, of the severe effect of which few are aware, that the waste and extravagance, the unauthorized imposition of duties and appropriations of money for unconstitutional objects would have been tolerated for a single year?" Can either of you tell me if this is representative of Southern thought during this time, that direct taxation is superior to other ways for the federal government to collect revenue? Maybe not. It's kind of an obscure question. Let me tell you why I'm interested in it. You may have heard that there is a new book out by these economists, Saez and Zuckman, who are advisors to the Warren campaign. And of course, there are lots and lots of arguments about that, but it also purports to be a history of taxation. And one of their claims is that the biggest opponents of direct taxation of wealth were Southern slaveholders. Now, I recognize that recently there's been a trend among certain historians to try to connect anything they don't like to slavery. The Electoral College, the Second Amendment, this seems like another attempt to do that, even though Saez and Zuckman are economists rather than historians. But if what Hayne is saying here is really representative of what Southern slaveholders in 1830 believed, this would seem to be a very powerful argument against that. But like I said, I don't want to get too stuck on that. Any of you have any comment on that?
I think that's a great point, John. I honestly had not thought of it that way. And I don't know if what Hayne is saying here is indicative of the South as a whole. I mean, right, certainly the larger population of the North, right, and the industries of the North in comparison to the much lower population of the South. I'm not quite sure what the difference in population between the two is here by 1830. By the time the Civil War starts, I mean, the population of the North is 21 million compared to 9 million in the South, 4 million of which will be slaves. And, right, I don't know the exact numbers here in 1830, but, right, taxation of individuals, right, by pushing that forward, it certainly makes more sense from the Southern point of view, as opposed to taxing the states.
Yeah, the poll tax, which, even though the word poll tax makes you think you pay it at election day, mm-hmm. paid by voters, is actually a capitation tax. Mm. That was a tax on slaves. So slave owners had to pay a tax for their slaves. But like I said, this might be something we want to move on from. It might be a distraction from the larger point. We have a more comment than a question from Amanda Bell. Hayes gives a great defense of what he believes will keep the general government in check. If you can eliminate the slavery component, it is thought-provoking. Reaction to that? What do you think of his argument on how the federal government can be limited?
Can you repeat the question again, John? I missed a portion.
Sure. Hayne gives a great defense of what he believes will keep the general government, I assume that means federal government, in check. mm-hmm. can eliminate the slavery component, it is thought-provoking.
Well, I would first of all say that's a hard thing to respond to, given all of his talk about state interposition, which is highly problematic for a lot of the reasons that Daniel Webster points out, that, you know, the ultimate check on the government is the states themselves, and state sovereignty allowing states to interpose, which Haynes says is Jefferson's doctrine and is Madison's doctrine, borrowing from the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions, suggesting that these doctrines go back to the origins of the Republic and to the original thinkers of the Republic. You know, the idea of using state interposition as a fundamental check on government, Webster makes the case, I think, quite persuasively that this is ultimately the grounds for the disintegration of the Union, and is going to lead to nothing but anarchy and probably violence at the end.
What is the difference between the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions and the doctrine of interposition?
Well, one goes further than the other. Madison in the Virginia resolutions talks about state interposition, but he claims that he never meant by that an individual state could interpose and nullify legislation. He said that he meant that is the states in their collective capacity could act to resist legislation that they found to be unconstitutional or they believed was not in the state's interests.
And Madison is still alive at this point in 1830, right? And so Hayne and even Calhoun later will invoke Madison in the Virginia resolutions to say, see, the founding generation is with us when we argue in favor of nullification or states' rights or secession or whatever you want to call it, the veto, whatever you want to call it. Madison is still alive. He says, wait a second, I did it. That is not what I meant.
Yeah, that's why Madison writes his letter saying that's not at all what I was saying mm-hmm. in there. Now, the Kentucky resolutions, Jefferson does go a bit further and seems to come pretty close to endorsing a view that an individual state can interpose and nullify legislation. But it is worth remembering that the Kentucky resolutions were immensely unpopular. The other states were actually quite outraged when they were published at the thought that one member state could nullify legislation passed by all the others. They thought this was fairly outrageous, and Kentucky actually went back and modified the Kentucky resolutions to moderate them significantly so that they didn't sound quite so radical. So Haynes is referring to one version of the Kentucky resolutions. He's not actually referring to the final version of the Kentucky resolutions. But that's the key difference between them, is whether or not an individual state can interpose. Webster, of course, dismisses all of this by saying, no, what both of them were talking about was simply the right of revolution. And he says, obviously, the right of revolution is never surrendered. And, you know, if you believe your rights are being violated, you can always take up arms. You can always overthrow the government and institute new government in its place. But that's not really what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with a tariff bill. That's not what the founders had in mind when they were writing up the right of revolution.
After this discussion by Webster about the Union, is it only meant to be temporary? The Union is essential to the prosperity and safety of the states. There's an ellipsis, and then we get into this brief mention of the Ordinance of 1787, the Northwest Ordinance. And it seems to me that this is what really sets paying off.
Hmm.
Could you explain, both of you, I hope, what is going on here? Maybe tell us a little bit what's included in this part that's left out, how he makes this jump to the ordinance of 1787, and why this question of the ordinance is interpreted by Hayne as an attack on the South.
Yeah, I can take a shot at that. I'm not certain of the answer, but right, the Northwest Ordinance, it was one of those few pieces of legislation that was passed more than once. It was passed under the Congress by the old Articles of Confederation and also by the new Congress under the Constitution of 1787, just to make sure that it was legal. But in both cases, it outlaws slavery in the territories. And it is, you know, passed by a Congress composed by many men who had signed the Constitution. That Hayne doesn't see as right. So okay, take a step back here. According to Hayne, the Constitution is what has created the Union, supposedly allowing these states to be sovereign and independent, controlling their own institutions. But the Ordinance of 87 speaks directly against that right, so-called right of the states. And maybe even more than that, the Northwest Ordinance deals with the issue at the heart of these debates, right? The territories and the federal responsibility to the territories. What the Northwest Ordinance teaches us, and this is Lincoln's point, right, years later in 1859 at Cooper Union, is the Northwest Ordinance is important because it proves that the founders thought that the federal government had the authority to regulate slavery in the territories, had the authority to keep slavery out of the territories, which Hayne rejects. That might be part of the reason that off.
And significantly, this is done under the Articles of Confederation, the much weaker bond than the Constitution provides.
Right. The Congress under the Articles passes the Northwest Ordinance as well. And at one point, right, Webster accuses Hayne of, right, based on how Hayne is understanding the American Union and the American Constitution, Webster basically tells Hayne, it's like you don't realize that we're living under a new form of government, right? That the Constitution was actually passed, that we're not living under the old Articles of Confederation, with Articles 2 and 3 of that document, which had stated that, yes, the states retained their sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and there's a league of friendship among the states, and whatever powers the states haven't, right, conceded, they retain. Webster's charges, Hayne, you're still living back, you know, pre-U.S. Constitution. You know, get with the program, buddy.
Eric, anything you care to add to or amplify?
Yeah, I think one of the other things Hayne reacts to is what Webster also says about the Northwest Ordinance. He traces what has developed in the Northwest Territory since the time the ordinance was passed. And he makes the observation that the states that have formed north of the Ohio River have become populous, have industrialized, have become prosperous. He says they are flourishing. He points out that Ohio has the third highest population among all of the states in the Union at this point. He says, so everything is going, you know, smashingly well in the Northwest Territory. He says, but then you head south and you look at a place like Kentucky. He says, and it's barely developed. You know, you basically have a few agrarians. You have a large slave population. They're not producing much revenue. They're not doing well economically. And he doesn't spell it out, but he certainly insinuates that the new territories that are becoming states, that are coming in as free states, are doing much better and are becoming a lot more prosperous than the states that are coming in as slave states.
Okay.
And that seems to be a direct attack on slavery and the institution. as retarding economic growth and getting in the way of progress.
Now, you had, Eric, you had mentioned earlier that that Webster was trying to bait Hayne into laying out the Carolina Doctrine in all its glory. Is this what you were talking about here? He's intentionally needling him over the difference in development between Ohio and Kentucky?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the pieces. I think there's actually several parts of his first reply to Hayne that, you know, has him needling at slavery and needling at Southern interests. But this is certainly one of the most pronounced places where he, you know, makes the strong inference that slavery is weak economically. And Hayne has to come back in his second reply, and he has to say, well, look, you know, you're suggesting that, you know, we wouldn't be able to contribute to the common defense because we don't have a strong enough white population. And he says, well, that's ridiculous. Only a small part of the white population would participate in a war. We'd be able to offer up equal to anything the North would do. Plus, we'd have all of these slaves that would be continue producing for us while we were fighting. So we'd be able to contribute just as much as anywhere else in the country. But he's got him on the defensive with this in suggesting that, that slavery is not really that profitable economically. Again, is really a drag on economic prosperity and progress.
And as Stacey Moses points out, this is literally the same thing that Governor Morris says about the slave states in the Constitutional Convention. Mm-hmm. Jason, you care to add to or amplify any of that?
Yeah, I just maybe can amplify that by going to Hayne's reply to Webster. He says, sir, when the gentleman provokes me to such a conflict, he's talking about Webster here, I meet him at the threshold. I will struggle while I have life for our altars and our firesides, and if God gives me strength, I will drive back the invader discomfited. Or shall I stop there? If the gentleman provokes the war, he shall have war. Sir, I will not stop at the border. I will carry the war into the enemy's territory and not consent to lay down my arms until I shall have obtained indemnity for the past and security for the future.
Yeah, so that word provoked, you know, he certainly took that as a direct challenge. And again, I mean, it's hard to prove what Webster's intentions were when he was delivering his reply to Hayne, but it certainly looks as though he was goading Hayne into making a full-throated defense of the Carolina Doctrine and his view of union.
Now, maybe it's just because I'm a Northerner, but that looks, Hayne's response looks like an outrageous overreaction to what was said. Mm-hmm. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. But again, I'm a Northerner too, so I just maybe
well,
I don't see it.
You teach in Georgia.
I teach in Georgia, and damn it, man, it was an offense.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Hayne clearly reads a lot into Webster's speech. Webster complains at one point that it was Senator Benton who had made the direct attack, on the East. Or, excuse me, Hayne complains at one point that Senator Benton was the one who had made the direct attack on the East. And Webster is now going after Hayne as though he made the comments. So he seems to act as though Webster was in a peevish mood when he pronounced his reply. But I think Webster knew exactly what he was doing. I mean, this is one of the most accomplished orators in American history. I mean, this is not a guy who does things by accident. He's referred to as the Demosthenes of the North. The papers referred to him as godlike Daniel. He was also referred to as Black Dan for some of his less savory aspects of his character. But that being said, I mean, this is somebody who knew his way around rhetorically. I don't think he did anything by accident. I think he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew how to needle Hayne in just the right way to provoke the response that he ended up getting. And I think he expected it, and Hayne took, as I said earlier, took the bait.
I think, and I also think Hayne's, his final speech there on January 27th, he takes a step back. He seems to have cooled down a bit. That speech is much more philosophic than his previous ones. That is replying to Webster's second speech. He doesn't seem like the firebrand maybe that he was earlier. Not to say that he's lost that, but maybe has gotten more control over himself by the end of the debates.
Now, maybe we should turn, although we've already alluded to it, Hayne's defense of slavery. So could you walk us through that?
Well, Hayne takes the older view of the defense of slavery, the one that was in place at the time of the American founding, where Southerners really defended slavery as a necessary evil. Instead of being a positive good, the positive good argument doesn't really start coming out until the late 1830s, early 1840s. And of course is buttressed by the emergence of sociology and the ethnographic studies, that start coming out, proving scientifically, the superiority of the white race, over the inferior races. And you start getting it preached from the pulpits, and you start getting it talked about every day as being a positive good for society. Hayne really talks about it more as being something that was foisted on the South, that this was really the fault of the English. They were the ones who brought slavery to America. The South accepted it unwillingly, but, you know, they had no choice. And so they've cared for the slaves and taken care of them ever since. He talks about the fact that we can't really talk about recolonization. It's just impractical. But we can't talk about freeing the slaves because they're inferior and they couldn't live co-equally with whites in society. So the only thing we can do is leave them where they are. We're just kind of stuck with slavery as it is. But he almost writes about it as though it's a tragedy. It's something that's just happened, and we have to accept, rather than something that is a conscious choice and is something that we're embracing overall. At this time, even Calhoun is still making more of the necessary evil types of arguments about slavery. It's still going to be about a decade off before they shift their language and start talking about slavery as a positive good and the mud sill theory that you talked about and all of those types of things.
Yeah, that's a good point. I tend to see much more of sort of the Calhounian way of viewing slavery in Hayne than the founding view of slavery. Hayne's second speech on January 25th, 1830, which I think we quoted from before. He says there in the paragraph beginning with thousands of these deluded victims of fanaticism. He says, "Sir, there does not exist on the face of the whole earth a population so poor, so wretched, so vile, so loathsome, so utterly destitute of all the comforts, conveniences, and of life, as the unfortunate blacks of Philadelphia and New York and Boston. Liberty has been to them the greatest of calamities, the heaviest of curses. Sir, I have had some opportunities of making comparisons between the condition of the free Negroes of the North and the slaves of the South. And the comparison has left not only an indelible impression of the superior advantages of the latter, but has gone far to reconcile me to slavery itself. That sounds to me indistinguishable from what you'll hear coming out of Southern apologists of the later 1830s and 1840s and 1850s. That sounds like Calhoun. That sounds like George Fitzhugh, right, of the 1850s. That sounds like John Henry Hammett, Mudsill theory, and others, right? He is, maybe he's occupying sort of this middle ground between the founding and the Calhounian positive good school. But he says, right, I've been reconciled to slavery based upon my experiences. And this sounds like you could pull this directly from, you know, Fitzhugh's Cannibals All or Sociology of the South.
Yeah, he is a transitional figure. There's no question about that. Ever since he entered the Senate, I think in 1821, 1822, something like that, he was known as a defender of slavery. That was his major issue. That he joined in on debate and participated with. He was certainly being goaded on by Calhoun. Calhoun's presiding over this entire debate in the Senate. And it was reported that Hayne was receiving notes throughout the debate when he was speaking. And it was widely understood that the notes were coming from Calhoun himself.
Calhoun is vice president at this time. Is that right?
Yeah, he's vice president at this time. So he's presiding over the Senate and is actually present. And at one point, Daniel Webster in the in his second reply, one of the statements he makes about the nature of the Union stops and actually looks up and stares directly at Calhoun. And pauses for, a moment and then returns back to his notes and continues speaking.
Stacy Moses asks, if Daniel Webster was purposefully needling Hayne, what was the goal?
Eric, I'll let you take that one.
Yeah, I think for Webster, this was a debate that needed to happen. This was somebody needed to speak up and confront the Carolina Doctrine. It is kind of amazing that the exposition and protest comes out and there is no major refutation of it. Nobody in national politics takes a stand and says, no, this is wrong. This is not the correct theory of the Constitution. This is not the correct theory of the Union. And I think Webster sees it as falling on his shoulders to be the person to make that defense and to stand up and say, no, this is not what we mean by constitutional government. This is not what the founders had in mind. This is not what we want for America. The problem is he doesn't necessarily want to be the one to pick a direct fight with anybody over the issue. So, you know, he takes this innocuous, you know, lands bill debate with Hayne making some veiled comments, but by and large, a pretty benign, first speech on it. And then comes back with the needling in his first reply. And there's just, all those little points where he seems to just be goading Hayne to respond to the Carolina Doctrine, to slavery, to Southern interests, to issues over the tariff, to issues over internal improvements. All the major issues of the day, but also of these two issues of major importance, slavery and the Union. And he sees himself as the guardian of the Republic. And he's going to be the one to speak out and offer the rebuttal of the states' rights position, since nobody else has been willing to stand up and do it. I mean, even Henry Clay didn't speak out about it.
It's amazing to me. South Carolina Exposition and Protest is made in 1828. For a full 2 years that any kind of reaction is made against it. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I think it's a couple of things. One, there was, I think, a common understanding of don't mess with South Carolina. You know, it's just that's a fight nobody really wants to engage in. South Carolina,
Jackson.
You know, South Carolina had some real firebrands, and you know, you were in for a major fight if you took them on directly. At the same time, I don't know how seriously people took it. I mean, this is something passed by the South Carolina legislature. It's a theoretical doctrine. It spells out this theory of states' rights and this theory of nullification. But of course, South Carolina had not actually tried to nullify legislation at this point. And I think everybody was just kind of waiting with bated breath to see what was going to happen with the Tariff of Abominations. And to see if Congress was going to repeal the tariff, to see if Congress was going to balk. A lot of people, I think, thought South Carolina was bluffing. There was, I think, a lot of calculation that South Carolina was just making an enormous bluff in trying to suggest that they could do this. And if they got their way on the tariff, they'd back down. But even if they didn't get their way on the tariff, they'd eventually back down. Turns out they were wrong. They obviously were willing to carry through on the threat. I can't point to a specific reason why nobody decides to take this on and really try a rebuttal. But I think that's what Webster's trying to do in 1830.
Jason, any thoughts on this?
Yeah, that was really interesting to hear, and I agree with Eric on that. Right, of course, it's not until 1832 when Andrew Jackson will who is not a friend of strong national governments by any stretch of the imagination, will actually stand up and respond to the South Carolina doctrine in a forceful way. He's not the he doesn't have Webster's oratory. Right, but Jackson's stand against nullification, and putting, forcing South Carolina to withdraw the threat of nullification from the table, really saves the Union, or at least puts off secession for another 30 years.
We're coming to the end of our time. There's plenty more that could be said. I do have another question here. James Tolar is asking us to step back a little bit. Do you believe that South Carolina would have ratified the Constitution if the South Carolinians believed they would have to give up so much power to the federal government?
Yeah, that's certainly an argument that you get from many of the secessionist advocates during the Civil War. That the states would not have entered into this compact, into this agreement, if they did not think they could also get out of it, if they so chose, if they desired. I don't know how much stock I would put in that argument, simply because the Constitution is silent on the question of secession. Right, at the best, the Constitution is ambiguous about whether or not a state can or cannot secede. And I think that's right. Lincoln, for instance, when he goes to prepare to write his first inaugural address, responding to that argument, right, responding to that Southern argument that secession is legal and constitutional, one of the sources that he takes with him as he prepares to write his first inaugural is Webster's second speech, Webster's second reply to Hayne. Lincoln looks to Webster as an authority, as an inspiration on when it comes to composing his own first inaugural, and he borrows many of his arguments for the perpetuity of the Union, for example, from Webster. But those arguments aren't founded just here in Webster. Those arguments go back to the founding itself. Right during the course of the debates, right, they bring up the Articles of Confederation. We often forget that the official title of the Articles of Confederation was the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union, right? So the argument that Webster is making throughout these debates, that the Union is meant to be perpetual and to endure forever, and that Hayne rejects, it was there as part of, right, the official title of the Articles of Confederation. And so although I think there, again, there you definitely see that argument, I'm not sure how much stock I'm willing to put in it.
Eric.
Yeah, I'm generally in agreement with Jason. I don't think it's clear by 1830 that South Carolina actually has given up a lot of power. You know, we've had two significant Supreme Court cases by this point, both argued by Daniel Webster on the side of the government. But McCulloch v. Maryland and Gibbons v. Ogden that certainly ceded a tremendous amount of power to the national government and pointed in the direction of increased centralization and greater power for the national government in general. But even still, I'm not all that convinced that South Carolina has given up a tremendous amount by 1830, so that, you know, looking back at that point, they could legitimately say, well, we regret our decision to ratify. I mean, those ratification debates were very robust. You know, those the states looked into the Constitution very thoroughly. South Carolina had, what was it, Jason, three delegates at the convention.
You're right. It was three, and then the two Pickneys. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and then the two Pickneys and stuff. So, I mean, they were well represented. I mean, Charles Pickney, you know, played a significant role at the convention. I think they were well advised about what they were getting into, and made a very informed choice in deciding to ratify the Constitution. So I'm not really inclined to buy into that argument that says they wouldn't have ratified.
What can you tell us about the public reaction to this debate? What was the fallout from it in the short term?
Goodness, I don't know. Eric, you want to help us understand that?
Well, the newspapers, for the most part, treated Daniel Webster as the winner.
I did not know that. That's interesting.
The newspapers did split along geographical lines. Southern newspapers tended to play up Haynes' part of the debate and suggest that, you know, he scored some major points, but the Northern newspapers all unanimously sided with Webster. And as I said, there were many parts of his second reply, which was the most famous piece. The galleries in the Senate were absolutely packed. Members of the House had come over to listen to Webster speak that day. Dignitaries came to hear Webster speak. Everybody was anticipating a magnificent speech, and they got it. This was considered one of the greatest of his career, and it was echoed in public sentiment that he really did get the best of the debate and that his view on union was the one that people thought they ought to adhere to. But again, it's only going to get but so much traction in the South, which is going to remain loyal to the South Carolinians and to eventually Calhoun. For at least a short period of time, Webster, you know, sweeps over the land, and people really do praise the speeches that he gives.
Well, we're about finished, but I want to ask each of you very quickly to give your best pitch. We have an audience here of 85, most if not all of whom are teachers. Give me your best pitch for why they should make time in their jam-packed curriculum to include the Webster-Hayne debate.
Well, I'll just say very quickly, I included it in the most recent Core Docs book on the causes of the Civil War. It's document number 4. If you want to understand the causes of the Civil War, you've got to encounter the Webster-Hayne debates. They're absolutely essential.
Eric, anything to add to that?
I would just say I would probably say excerpts from the Webster-Hain debate. the full debate is quite lengthy, and I think beyond the capacity for most high school students. But as Jason said, you know, for understanding the Civil War, but also for really understanding, you know, the nature of the Union, and you know what the founders were trying to accomplish. In creating constitutional government, Webster articulates it as well as anyone in American history. And I think it's well worth the effort to read what he has to say.
All right. That's about all the time we have. I want to thank both of our panelists, Eric and Jason, as well as our participants for their thoughtful questions. Just as a reminder, you will be receiving an email within the next week. That email will include a link for a certificate of participation, as well as a link to the archived webinar. Please, I encourage you, I implore you, share that with your colleagues, share it on social media, help get the word out about this webinar. If you have enjoyed tonight's webinar, please consider taking an online graduate course in our Master of Arts in American History and Government program. Eric and Jason, of course, both teach in that program. I am chair of that program, so it has a special place in my heart. You can find more information about our online course offerings, as well as many other resources for teachers at teachingamericanhistory.org. Our next Documents in Detail webinar will take place on Wednesday, December 18th, our special Christmas edition. Our topic will be John C. Calhoun's speech on the Oregon Bill. And let's face it, at Christmas time, who doesn't want to cuddle up with John Calhoun? Joining me to discuss the document at that time will be Will Addo of the University of Dallas, and Eric Sands will be joining us again for that. So we look forward to seeing you back here on December 18th. Once again, thank you and good night.
Thank you for listening to another TAH.org podcast. You can find archives of all our previous programs, as well as information about future programs at tah.org/webinars, or on iTunes by searching for teachingamericanhistory.org.